This is the Africa Debrief by Atlas News. Hello and welcome to the Africa Debrief by Atlas News, where we take an in-depth look at the region's top stories and analyze and explain them to you. Starting off, we dive into the situation in Ethiopia following the signing of the Pretoria Agreement in November 2022, which aimed to end the devastating Tigray War. We'll be examining whether the agreement's provisions have been implemented and the challenges that lie ahead for achieving lasting peace. The Pretoria Agreement, brokered by the African Union, AU, was a beacon of hope after 2 years of brutal conflict. It called for a ceasefire, disarmament of Tigrayan forces, humanitarian aid access, and the return of Tigrayan administration. The upcoming strategic review by the AU will assess progress on these fronts. The Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, believes the review is overdue, emphasizing full implementation as the key to peace. The U.S. has also sent a special envoy to attend the review and discuss the wider situation in Ethiopia. So has the Pretoria Agreement been successful? The answer is complex. On the positive side, the agreement silenced the guns. However, significant hurdles remain. Tigray lacks representation in the federal government, a right guaranteed by the agreement. Additionally, while the TPLF handed over heavy weapons, demobilization of their fighters, a crucial step towards peace, is incomplete. The humanitarian situation in Tigray is particularly concerning. The region faces a potential famine, reminiscent of the horrific tragedy of the 1980s. Wartime destruction of farmland and a continued blockade on aid have exacerbated a pre-existing drought. The Pretoria Agreement mandated aid access, but deliveries have been sporadic due to accusations of theft and bureaucratic hurdles. Another major obstacle to peace is the continued occupation of Tigrayan territory. Eritrean forces remain in the north, while Amhara regional forces occupy western Tigray. The agreement calls for Ethiopian troops to deploy along international borders, safeguarding Ethiopia's territorial integrity. This ongoing occupation directly contradicts this provision. The upcoming AU review is a critical juncture. While it's likely to reveal shortcomings in implementing the agreement, the question remains: will concrete action follow? Ethiopia holds significant influence within the AU, making it difficult to pressure them. Finding a durable solution requires addressing all aspects of the agreement. This includes ensuring Tigrayan representation, completing fighter demobilization, facilitating unrestricted aid access, and the withdrawal of occupying forces. Open communication and addressing grievances on all sides are also crucial. The talks between the Ethiopian government and the TPLF are a positive step, but much work lies ahead. The international community must play a role in pressuring all parties to fully implement the Pretoria Agreement and prevent a return to violence. We'll continue to monitor developments in Tigray and bring you further updates. Next, South Africa's upcoming elections in May 2024 are generating significant buzz, with concerns about potential irregularities and the main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, DA, seeking international support to ensure a free and fair vote. The DA has written a letter to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, requesting assistance in several key areas. These include deploying independent observers within South Africa to monitor the elections, providing resources to civil society groups that educate voters, and offering technological support to combat online misinformation. President Cyril Ramaphosa of the ruling African National Congress, ANC, has criticized the DA's letter, claiming it undermines South Africa's sovereignty. He accuses the DA of mortgaging our democracy and suggests their request has a hidden agenda. Why is the DA concerned? The DA cites several factors that raise concerns about the upcoming elections. The rise of the MK Party. Led by former President Jacob Zuma, this new party is gaining traction in KwaZulu-Natal province, a traditional ANC stronghold. The DA believes this could threaten national stability, particularly if the MK party disrupts peaceful political discourse. Following Zuma's arrest warrant, KwaZulu-Natal witnessed violent riots that resulted in hundreds of deaths and widespread destruction. While a government report found no direct link between Zuma and the riots, the DA expresses concern that such violence could resurface. The DA fears the ruling party, facing declining popularity, might resort to unfair tactics to retain power. This includes forging alliances with foreign actors who have questionable democratic practices. The DA's request for international support has sparked debate. While some see it as a legitimate effort to safeguard democracy, others view it as an attack on South Africa's sovereignty. The upcoming review by the AU regarding the implementation of the Pretoria Agreement in Ethiopia, discussed in the previous podcast, highlights the importance of free and fair elections throughout Africa. Ensuring a peaceful and transparent vote in South Africa will be crucial for the country's stability and democratic future. Now, the relationship between the United States and Zimbabwe is facing fresh challenges after a reported incident involving USAID officials. Here's a breakdown of the situation. Samantha Power, head of USAID, accused Zimbabwean security services of detaining, intimidating, and deporting USAID officials who were assessing the country's development and governance situation. This included verbal abuse, overnight detention, and unsafe transportation. Power condemned these actions as a grave development and highlighted similar past incidents involving U.S. officials and citizens. She questioned Zimbabwe's commitment to democratic reforms and re-engagement with the international community. Earlier this week, the U.S. lifted general sanctions on Zimbabwe, but maintained targeted sanctions against 11 individuals and three entities linked to corruption and human rights abuses. President Mnangagwa, his wife, and the vice president are all included on this list. The U.S. has expressed concern over Zimbabwe's democratic decline under President Mnangagwa's ZANU-PF party. Political freedoms have shrunk, and opposition leader Nelson Chamisa resigned in January, alleging government interference. This incident highlights the complex situation in Zimbabwe. The government seeks to consolidate power while relying on foreign aid, like the recent $11.27 million food aid donation from USAID. However, such actions strain relations with donors who are crucial for the nation's well-being. The U.S. response to the alleged mistreatment of USAID officials remains to be seen. This incident could further complicate U.S.-Zimbabwe relations and hinder efforts to promote democracy and human rights in the country. Next up, we'll delve into a recent Lesotho court case that highlights the complex interplay between traditional beliefs and the legal system. The case involves Kwaban Mojela, a principal chief who shot and killed his cousin, Tsenolo Letsi. The defense successfully argued that Mojela's deep-rooted belief in witchcraft constituted an extenuating factor, sparing him from the death penalty. Lesotho, a small nation in southern Africa, is known for its rich cultural heritage, where traditional beliefs, including witchcraft, hold significant weight, particularly in rural areas. People frequently consult traditional healers for medical and spiritual purposes, and sometimes even to inflict harm on others. The case centered around Mojela's claim that Letsi was practicing witchcraft against him. Advocate Jafta Tamai, representing Mojela, emphasized his client's belief system and how it influenced his actions. He portrayed Mojela as a normal human being who acted impulsively due to his fear of being harmed by witchcraft. This defense strategy proved successful, despite medical evidence presented by the prosecution. A doctor from Scott Hospital testified that Mojela had been admitted in 2019 for epilepsy, exhibiting violent tendencies, and had neglected to take his prescribed medication. The judge, Justice Mabatsoeneng Hlaele, acknowledged the cultural context in his closing statement. He recognized that Mojela's upbringing and surroundings heavily influenced his belief in witchcraft, which the court considered as an extenuating factor in the case. The lack of premeditation was also cited as a mitigating factor. Ultimately, the court ruled against the death penalty for Mohela due to the extenuating circumstances. The sentencing hearing is scheduled for March 21, 2024. This case raises intriguing questions about balancing traditional beliefs with legal frameworks. While Lesotho's legal system follows a Western model, this case demonstrates the court's willingness to acknowledge the influence of cultural norms on an individual's actions. The verdict reflects a nuanced approach that considers the cultural context surrounding the crime. It's important to note that this is just one instance, and the legal weight given to witchcraft beliefs may vary depending on the specifics of each case. Nevertheless, the Mohela case sheds light on the ongoing conversation about integrating cultural understandings into the legal system, particularly in societies where traditional beliefs hold significant sway. Now, we're focusing on a recent seizure of weapons by the Multinational Joint Task Force, MNJTF, in Niger. This incident sheds light on the ongoing fight against Boko Haram and the wider security challenges in the Lake Chad Basin, LCB, region. On the surface, the story seems straightforward. The MNJTF discovered a cache of arms, including rocket launchers and assault rifles, in a vehicle traveling through Niger. However, this event is deeply rooted in a complex and long-standing conflict. Boko Haram, a violent extremist group with roots in Nigeria's Borno state, is notorious for its attacks on civilians and kidnappings. The recent abduction of hundreds of schoolgirls serves as a stark reminder of the brutality they inflict. The weapons seized were most likely linked to Boko Haram, and the vehicle originated in Nigeria. This highlights the porous nature of borders in the LCB, a region encompassing parts of Chad, Niger, Nigeria, and Cameroon. This lack of border security allows Boko Haram to operate transnationally, posing a threat to all countries in the region. The MNJTF itself is a testament to the regional approach needed to tackle this issue. Established by Nigeria and bolstered by troops from Chad and Niger, it later expanded to include Cameroon and received support from the African Union. This international cooperation reflects the understanding that Boko Haram isn't just a Nigerian problem, but a threat demanding a united front. However, the fight against Boko Haram is far from over. The group's decentralized structure makes it difficult to target its leadership, and the vastness of the LCB provides ample hiding spaces. Additionally, the region grapples with widespread poverty and lack of government control, creating fertile ground for extremist ideologies to take root. The MNJTF's recent seizure is a positive development, but it's just one battle in a long war. Long-term solutions require addressing the root causes of extremism, fostering economic development, and strengthening regional cooperation to secure borders and improve intelligence sharing. Next, we're shifting our focus to a recent human trafficking case involving a former Zimbabwean police officer, Forward Mashonganyika. This story exposes the dark side of labor migration and the challenges Oman faces in tackling human trafficking. Mashonganyika was convicted alongside Tendai Muswe for luring women to Oman under false pretenses of jobs in Dubai. The victims faced forced domestic servitude, physical and sexual abuse, and were overall treated terribly. This case highlights the vulnerability of foreign workers, particularly women, in Oman. The United States Department of State's Trafficking in Persons report paints a concerning picture. Many migrant workers, especially from Africa and Asia, are lured by traffickers with promises of jobs that never materialize. Once in Oman, they face a harsh reality: unpaid wages, limited movement, horrific abuse, and confiscation of passports. Despite having laws against human trafficking, Oman's enforcement seems weak. Many cases go uninvestigated, and victims can even be arrested for leaving abusive employers. This creates a climate of fear, making it harder for victims to come forward and escape their situations. The role of corrupt officials further complicates the situation. Some fail to follow proper procedures for identifying victims, especially domestic workers experiencing abuse. In some instances, the police return victims to their abusers or detain them on charges filed by their employers. The recent arrest of Mashonga Nyika offers a glimmer of hope, but it's just a small step. Oman needs significant reforms to address human trafficking effectively, strengthening law enforcement, implementing stricter regulations on recruitment agencies, and ensuring proper procedures for identifying and supporting victims are crucial. Next, we'll explore a recent development aimed at improving the lives of people in Mozambique. Italy has pledged millions of dollars to fund a project that supports agriculture in two war-torn provinces. The project, titled Maize Valor 2, Project for Improving the Inclusive and Sustainable Development of Agricultural Value Chains, is a collaboration between the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, UNIDO, and Mozambique's Ministry of Industry and Commerce. Funded by a $4.4 million pledge from the Italian Agency for Development Cooperation, Maize Valor 2 targets the provinces of Manica and Cabo Delgado. These regions have suffered greatly from attacks by extremist groups, displacing people and disrupting their livelihoods. Maize Valor 2 builds upon the success of an earlier project, Maize Valor 1, which focused on coffee production on Ibo Island in Cabo Delgado. The new project aims to expand coffee production and introduce new initiatives, such as establishing a fruit and vegetable industry in these provinces. UNIDO representative to Mozambique, Jamie Muniz, emphasized the project's potential to empower small and medium-sized businesses and create job opportunities for young people. This economic empowerment is seen as a crucial step towards bringing stability to the region. Mozambique's Ministry of Industry and Commerce shares this view. They believe that Maize Valor 2 can improve the lives of people in these war-torn areas and foster economic and social stability. Italy's investment aligns with their broader strategy for Africa, unveiled by Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni at the Italy-Africa Summit earlier this year. The Mattei Development Plan allocates nearly $6 billion towards development projects in Africa, focusing on education, agriculture, healthcare, and energy infrastructure. Meloni also envisions Italy as a future hub for transporting African natural gas to Europe. Maize Valor 2 offers a beacon of hope for the people of Manica and Cabo Delgado. By supporting the agricultural sector, this project has the potential to create jobs, improve livelihoods, and foster stability in a region recovering from conflict. We'll continue to follow developments in Mozambique and keep you updated on the progress of Maize Valor 2. Next, we delve into the upcoming Pan-African Congress. Pan-Africanism, a concept advocating for unity and the well-being of all people of African descent, is taking center stage as Mali prepares to host the first of six preparatory conferences leading up to the 9th Pan-African Congress in Lomé, Togo this October. The Mali Conference, scheduled for May 14th and 15th, will focus on the theme Diasporas, Afro-Descendants, and Development. This theme reflects the growing importance of the African diaspora in a world grappling with issues of migration. Discussions are expected to center on strengthening ties between African nations and their diasporic communities, exploring how these connections can contribute to continental development. But this is just one piece of the puzzle. The broader theme of the 9th Pan-African Congress is renewal of Pan-Africanism and Africa's role in the reform of multilateral institutions. This ambitious theme highlights a desire to explore Pan-Africanism's role in a changing world. Organizers hope to use the Congress as a platform to discuss how African nations can work together to navigate an increasingly complex geopolitical landscape. They'll also delve into how Pan-Africanism can be a driving force in reforming international institutions to better represent Africa's interests. The ultimate goal? To develop a declaration that outlines a vision for the African in this evolving world. This declaration, along with strategies for mobilizing resources within Africa, could serve as a roadmap for the continent's future. It's important to understand the context behind this gathering. The Lomé Congress was authorized by the African Union, AU, in 2023, coinciding with their declaration of the Decade of African Roots and the African Diaspora. This initiative aims to strengthen ties between Africa and its diaspora while harnessing their collective contributions towards achieving the goals set out in Agenda 2063. Agenda 2063, adopted by the AU in 2015, is a blueprint for Africa's development over the next 50 years. It emphasizes sustainable and inclusive socioeconomic growth. The Pan-African Congress can be seen as a crucial step in implementing this ambitious agenda. By bringing together Africans on the continent and in the diaspora, the hope is to foster collaboration and develop a unified front. This renewed Pan-Africanism could be the key to unlocking Africa's full potential and ensuring its rightful place in the global arena. We'll be sure to follow the developments in Mali this May and keep you updated on the progress towards the 9th Pan-African Congress. Now, Haiti's descent into deeper political and security turmoil has thrown a wrench into plans for a Kenyan-led police deployment. This episode unpacks the reasons behind the delay and the wider context of this troubled Caribbean nation. Kenya originally committed to leading a multinational police force under the UN's banner to help quell gang violence in Haiti. However, several roadblocks have emerged. The first hurdle was a legal challenge in Kenya, arguing that deploying officers without a reciprocal agreement with Haiti was unconstitutional. This was partially overcome when Kenya and the then Haitian Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, signed such an agreement in March. However, Haiti's situation took a dramatic turn soon after. Gang violence escalated, with the powerful G9 gang, led by Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, launching attacks across the country. These attacks aimed to force Henry's resignation, and they succeeded. With Henry gone, the legitimacy of the signed agreement is now in question. Kenya has made it clear they won't deploy until a new, stable government is established in Haiti. This creates a waiting game, with no clear timeline for when an interim leader or council will be formed. The security situation in Haiti is dire. Homicides are on the rise, with kidnappings a constant threat. Haiti's own police force, numbering around 9,000, is vastly outnumbered and outgunned by the gangs. This has prompted the evacuation of embassy staff from several countries, including the U.S. and European nations. The U.S., a major backer of the deployment, remains hopeful that Kenya will take the lead once a new Haitian government is in place. Florida, the U.S. state closest to Haiti and a potential landing spot for migrants fleeing the violence, has already bolstered its security forces in anticipation of a worsening situation. The future of the deployment remains uncertain. Kenya's commitment seems unwavering, but it hinges on Haiti establishing a functional government and creating a safer environment for the international police force. We'll continue to monitor the situation and keep you updated on any developments. Finally, the MV Abdullah, a Bangladeshi cargo ship, continues to be held captive by Somali pirates off the coast of Somalia. This follows a dramatic week for the vessel and its crew, with some positive developments emerging this morning. Here's a quick recap. Earlier this week, on March 12th, the MV Abdullah was hijacked by a group of Somali pirates estimated to number between 20 and 50. The crew initially sought refuge in the ship's citadel, a secure area designed to withstand such situations. The pirates then steered the vessel towards the Somali coast. By March 14th, the pirates had moored the ship 20 nautical miles off the coast of Garakad, Somalia. The situation escalated as the pirates threatened to kill hostages on board if their ransom demands were not met. The ransom amount has not been made public. The European Union Naval Force, through Operation Atalanta, has been closely monitoring the situation. One of their vessels has been shadowing the hijacked ship. Now for the latest developments. This morning, EU naval forces reported a significant change. Apparently, more than half of the pirates have disembarked and returned to the Somali coast. This is a positive sign, and thankfully, the crew remained safe within the citadel. EU naval forces also clarified that their initial reports may have overestimated the number of pirates on board. Based on new visual information, they now believe there are around 12 pirates remaining on the MV Abdullah. The situation is still ongoing, and Operation Atalanta is actively coordinating with Bangladeshi and Somali authorities, along with other maritime security partners, to find the most effective course of action. This likely involves negotiations to secure the release of the crew and the vessel. It's important to note that the origin of these pirates may be linked to the hijacking of another vessel, the MV Rouen. Additionally, authorities have identified three possible pirate camps operating along the Somali coast, which may be supporting these hijacking activities. We'll continue to monitor this developing situation and keep you updated on any further news regarding the MV Abdullah and its crew. This has been the Africa Debrief by Atlas News.